From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with the most recognized baritone saxophonist in modern jazz, Jerry Mulligan. Through his playing, composing, and arranging, he helped create the sound that became known as cool jazz. Poet Li Yongli is the great-grandson of the first president of the Republic of China and the son of Mao's private physician. Coming up, Li tells us why his illustrious family history is both a blessing and a burden. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews a reissue of Fats Waller's later works, and TV critic David Bianculli reviews three new Christmas specials. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Frank Stacio. A U.S. officer shot and wounded a Panamanian corporal near an American installation today. It was the second shooting incident in 3 days between U.S. and Panamanian forces. American soldiers were put on maximum alert after the killing of a U.S. officer Saturday near Panamanian military headquarters. In Washington, President Bush called the killing of the American on Saturday an enormous outrage and would not rule out military action in response. According to the White House, National Security Advisor Brent Scowcroft made a secret visit to Beijing in July, just a month after the bloody government crackdown against pro-democracy demonstrators in Tiananmen Square. Spokesman Marlon Fitzwater said President Bush sent Scowcroft to China to personally underscore the United States' shock and concern about the violence. Fitzwater left open the possibility that Scowcroft or other top American officials had made other secret trips to China. Democratic National Committee Chairman Ron Brown commented on the administration's friendly overtures to the Chinese, saying there has not been a decision so out of touch with American values since the sale of arms to the Ayatollah. Romanian President Ceausescu is in Iran for a state visit despite violent protests in the western town. In his country, Pierre Victory reports from Romania and says the Romanian army has sealed the town.
The West Romanian town of Temesvara resembles a state of siege today following Saturday's violent demonstration against the communist authorities. Police units on street corners, tanks and armored personnel carriers on patrol, and helicopters flying overhead. All traffic in and out of the city is subject to an army search. Burnt-out cars and smashed shop windows are a visible reminder of just how violent the demonstration was. Some reports claim that as many as 400 demonstrators were killed, but this is impossible to confirm. Eyewitnesses talk of seeing dead bodies lying in the street. For National Public Radio News, this is Pierre Vickery.
Andrei Sakharov was buried in Moscow today. Anne Gerrels reports.
Early this morning, Soviet leader Gorbachev stood for a few minutes in the freezing rain by Sakharov's open coffin. Later, tens of thousands gathered at a Moscow sports complex for a last public farewell. Speaker after speaker recalled that Sakharov refused to compromise despite threats. Speaker after speaker asked the human rights champion to forgive all those who were too frightened to speak up in his defense. Accompanied by a Soviet army band, family and friends later made their way at dusk through a forested cemetery on the outskirts of Moscow. As his widow kissed him one last time, Sakharov's coffin was placed in the grave and flowers heaped on top. I'm Ann Gerrels in Moscow.
This is NPR News. Authorities in Savannah, Georgia, say a city councilman was critically injured late today when a letter bomb exploded in the law office where he works. Robert Robinson is listed in critical condition. The blast in Savannah occurred just hours after a bomb was discovered and removed from a federal courthouse in Atlanta, and 2 days after a bomb in the mail killed federal judge Robert Vance at his home in suburban Birmingham, Alabama. Today, a congressional report faulted the way Federal Aviation Administration has gone about improving airport security since the bombing of Pan Am Flight 103 last year. Kevin Niedermeyer has this report.
The General Accounting Office has cited four areas where it feels the FAA hasn't properly carried out increased security procedures at high-risk foreign airports. The report says the FAA hasn't established minimum training requirements and standards for the extra security measures. Other areas the GAO found to be deficient were passenger screening, airport security control, and security inspections. though these last three areas have seen some improvement recently, according to the GAO. The FAA concurs with most of the report's findings. According to the FAA, there are only a few security inspectors for all of Europe, but more are going to be dispatched. The GAO report was released during today's Presidential Commission on Aviation Safety hearing, looking into the airliner explosion over Lockerbie, Scotland, that killed 270 people. For National Public Radio, I'm Kevin Niedermeyer.
The scheduled pre-Christmas launch of the Space Shuttle Columbia was postponed today for the third time in a week because of delays in preparing the launch pad. NASA officials said today the launch, originally set for December 18th, is now rescheduled for January 8th. NASA blamed unfinished problems and remodeling work at the launch pad 39A for the postponement, but said the decision to wait until early January was also made to give shuttle workers time to do routine maintenance on launch computers. I'm Frank Stacio in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Since the 1950s, my guest Jerry Mulligan has been perhaps the leading baritone saxophonist in jazz. He's also made his mark as an arranger, writing for the Gene Krupa Band, the Miles Davis Birth of the Cool Sessions, and his own bands. In the early 1950s, Mulligan moved from New York to the West Coast and formed a quartet with Chet Baker. The group played a more temperate approach to bop that became known as cool jazz or West Coast jazz. This week, Mulligan is playing with the New York Philharmonic, which is performing two pieces he composed and arranged. This music is also featured on his recent album, Symphonic Dreams. I asked Jerry Mulligan what he keeps in mind when he's writing music for classical musicians who aren't used to playing jazz.
What I tried to accomplish in my piece was writing something that the orchestra was comfortable playing. In other words, writing rhythmically in a way that was their idiom, not trying to force the orchestra to play the jazz idiom. The orchestra has its own ways of swinging, you know. The whole sense of momentum comes organically from the orchestra. They don't have a rhythm section. So producing that sense of momentum, you have to go about it in different ways. And there are ways that are the musical language that the orchestra is used to, and that's what I tried to call upon, not trying to impose a strange idiom on them. That's especially on the piece called Entente, because that's a solo piece with the orchestra. The other piece that we played is a piece for the quartet with the written with an orchestral arrangement. That, of course, presents another set of problems, because when you put a rhythm section with an orchestra, you run into acoustic problems that you don't run into otherwise. You know, the presence of drums and cymbals, for instance. Cymbals have a tendency to ring in just the registers that are already occupied by the strings and woodwinds and tend to wipe them out. So each of these things presents particular problems, and so you have to use logic to solve them.
Well, let me play an excerpt of the Entente for baritone saxophone and orchestra. It's one of the pieces you'll be playing with the New York Philharmonic, and you recorded it a couple of years ago on an album called Symphonic Dreams,
right. Mm-hmm.
Which features you along with the Houston Symphony conducted by Eric Kunzel. Mm-hmm. So this is the Entente. Thank you. the Entente for baritone saxophone and orchestra, composed and arranged by my guest Jerry Mulligan, and this is one of the pieces he's performing in a series of concerts with the New York Philharmonic. Let's go backwards a little bit. You went on the road when you were a teenager. Was this against your parents' wishes, or did they think that that was okay?
Well, I think my parents accepted it as inevitable, and so they didn't stand in my way. I actually left high school to go on the road as an arranger with a band. And since that's what I wanted to do, and there was really no opportunity for me to go to music school, I insisted, and I got my way.
As you say, you went on the road as an arranger. One of your early arranging jobs was with the Gene Krupa band.
Mm-hmm.
Were you playing at all in the band at the beginning?
Not in the beginning, no. What happened, because I was a saxophone player and I always had at least one horn with me, if somebody got sick or somebody left unexpectedly, I would get called into service to help out. So that happened a couple of times during the year that I was with Gene Krupa's band. And it was a good experience because there were wonderful players in the band. I learned a great deal, but I felt like I was in deep water because I didn't feel that I was half the saxophone player that those other men were.
You were playing tenor, alto, and baritone at the time?
No, at first I played alto with the band for a while. The alto player left in the beginning of a tour, and I wound up having to play. And then some nights with the lead alto player got the flu or something happened to him, and I wound up coming to the job that night, finding out I had to play lead alto in the first crack out of the box. We were doing a radio show.
Oh, great.
That's called Learning Under Fire.
Yeah. Well, how did you start specializing on baritone?
I don't know. It's one of those things I never really remember thinking about. I bought a baritone when I was still in high school and never played it. It just got it because I liked it. I loved the way the baritone sounded in the band, and especially Harry Carney with the Duke Ellington band. And I suppose if I had been a string player rather than play violin, I probably would have chosen to play cello. And it probably has something to similar in choosing the baritone over the alto or the tenor, because it's in a similar register.
Mm-hmm. In the late 40s, you teamed up with arranger Gil Evans for what became one of the key recording sessions of modern jazz, the sessions that became known as the Birth of the Cool, mm-hmm. with Miles Davis and the Nonet. How did you and Evans first get together for these sessions?
Well, being an arranger with the band, I met the arrangers for all the other bands, and there was always a kind of a sense of camaraderie between the arrangers. That's separate from the other players. And I became very close with Gil. I loved the way he wrote. That Thornhill band had a very orchestral approach because Claude Thornhill himself was a pianist whose whole approach was very Debussy-like. He loved the French Impressionists, and he gave that kind of aura to the band, the way the things were orchestrated and the use of French horns and clarinets in the ensemble was quite unique at that time.
When you were writing for the Nonet, did you see that as a compromise between a big band and a small group?
Well, it's I suppose compromise is the word. We never thought of it as a compromise. What we were looking for was a vehicle that would give us the kind of rhythmic freedom that you have with a small group, with something of the orchestral colors that you have with the large ensemble. And what we wound up with there was a really kind of a basic cut down in size version of the Thornhill band. And having the six horns gave us a tremendous sense of ensemble.
Well, let's hear something from The Birth of the Cool. This is Giroux, composed and arranged by my guest baritone saxophonist Jerry Mulligan.
Thank you.
Jerry Mulligan is my guest, and why don't we take a short break, then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Baritone saxophonist, composer, and arranger Jerry Mulligan is my guest, and he's currently performing in a series of concerts with the New York Philharmonic. That's through December 19th, and they're playing several of his compositions. In the early 1950s, you moved to the West Coast. What brought you there?
Well, things were pretty rough in New York at that point. There were the places to work got fewer and fewer, and it was hard to make a living here. And the big bands that I had depended on to make a living were starting to die out. You know, the economy changed. And so I left New York and went to California to look for the land of opportunity.
And what you found there was trumpeter Chet Baker. and formed a quartet with him that ended up being the kind of seminal band that would define the sound that became known as the West Coast Sound or cool jazz. Tell me how you teamed up with Baker.
Well, when I went to California, I first started out through friends writing arrangements for Stan Kenton's band. And I used to spend a lot of time going around to jam sessions all over the Los Angeles area. And I encountered Chet a few times at sessions, and I liked very much the way he played. He had a very melodic approach, and he was a wonderful player. And so when it came time to put together something to take into a club to go to work, I finally wound up settled on this instrumentation with Chet. And so it was just a thing of proximity and opportunity, and it turned out to be the land of opportunity.
One of the things that distinguished your quartet was that it was a modern jazz group that didn't have a piano. Why didn't you have one?
Well, there were a couple of reasons for that, but the main reason was that the club we went into was a little place called The Hague in near downtown Los Angeles. When I first was playing on the off nights at this club, the main attraction in the club was Errol Garner. They had this beautiful concert grand piano on the stage. Well, the group following Errol was the trio of Red Norvo. Well, Red's instrumentation was, played the vibraphone, and he had a guitarist and a bass player. I think Charlie Mingus was with him then. And so they took this beautiful big grand piano out, and so I was going to play on the off nights. They said, well, they'll bring in a little upright. I said, no, you won't. Said, they go from this beautiful grand to upright, I won't do it. So I said, I'll put together a group that doesn't need a piano. And so it allowed me to put into practice something that we'd already tried in New York, rhythm section without a piano. And it worked very well.
Well, let me play something from your quartet with Chet Baker. This is a 1953 recording. It's your composition called Line for Lions. Thank you. My guest, Jerry Mulligan, with Chet Baker, their recording of Line for Lions from 1953. Well, while you were in the West Coast, you actually spent 3.5 months in a California prison on drug charges. You had been, you'd become addicted to heroin, as many of the jazz musicians of that time had become. Were you, what kind of prison were you in, and what was your life like while you were there?
Well, it wasn't very pleasant. And as far as prisons go, I suppose it wasn't very difficult because it was, I guess, a medium security compound out in the country north of Los Angeles. And some of the people in the prison, the guards and the wardens and all that, were very nice, and some were terrible. And they had, as I suppose they usually do, they had the people who were in there for various narcotics possessions were kind of kept together, and so it was, it could have been a lot worse. And the funny thing was, when as soon as I got there, it turns out that the people who were involved in the prison work of called the care and treatment, I mean, they had the big battle going between the people said the prison is for punishment and the other people saying, well, prison is for rehabilitation. And these people are always fighting with each other to get the upper hand, you know. Well, I no more than arrived in this place, and the care and treatment people came up and said, would you write a Christmas show for us? I said, sure. Well, that created a great deal of resentment with the people who thought that I was supposed to be being punished. And I found myself having a very hard time with some of the guards who were, you know, kind of the traditional sadistic types.
Huh.
And so it's kind of a pulling match between one and the other. And, well, I wound up putting a little band together and writing music for them, but wound up never doing the show because an organization called Narcotics Anonymous got a hold of a good lawyer. I had been very unlucky in the choice of lawyer. He was just a stupid man. I found out later that a lot of people that he had represented used to do things like put sugar in his gas tank and various things because he was such a rotten person. And it was very bad luck to wind up with somebody. Well, anyway, this organization and friends managed to get a rehearing, and they modified my sentence to time served and let me out. It was kind of a thing right out of a movie. It was, I think, the day or two before Christmas, and they took me into the down into the city to go to the court to have this hearing. And I think that the bus or the car that I was in to go down there got stuck in traffic, so by the time we got there, the hearing was already over, and I had been released. And it must have totally stunned the other people that I was in prison with, because they said nobody gets modified on a short sentence. It was a 6-month sentence to begin with. And so that was amazing. So the day before Christmas, I was released.
I want to ask you about a story that Nat Hentoff told in a New Yorker profile of you years ago. And he told the story of how when you were arranging with the Gene Krupa band, and this was in the 1940s, you were very young. One night, on the bandstand with the audience there, you started chewing out the band for being sloppy and telling Krupa that, you know, he was irresponsible for allowing that sloppiness to happen. Pretty nervy for a young musician.
Yes, but I did not tell Gene Krupa off for allowing it to happen.
Oh, okay.
But what happened was, it wasn't a night in New York. We had a long plane trip into Atlantic City, New Jersey, or someplace, and we were playing in the afternoon. And yes, you know, it was a thing that's always kind of amazed me about myself, is that I was a terrible sideman, because I was always, you know, I kind of elected myself the conscience, the musical conscience of the band. And you do things like that when you're young. You're idealistic and so on. But I didn't learn how to be a good sideman in a band until after I'd been a leader and realized what you really should contribute. I didn't know how to contribute to the organization in terms of attitude. And so I was kind of a bristly person in that way.
So maybe you don't have the temperament to be a sideman.
That's true.
Maybe you have to be a leader.
Well, I think that's right. There are a lot of things about being a sideman that are so far from my personality. I could never be a studio musician to play music and learn it and play it once and that's the end of it. Music is, to me, something that has to live every day. And when I play a piece of music that I like, I want to play it a lot. I don't want to just play it once. So, I think you're right. There's a little bit of a personality problem there to be a success playing with a band.
Well, Jerry Mulligan, I thank you very much for talking with us about your music. Thank you.
Pleasure.
Jerry Mulligan will be performing his compositions Entente and K4 Pacific with the New York Philharmonic through December 19th. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, my guest will be actor Charles Grodin. I hope you can join us. Here's Jerry Mulligan playing one of his own compositions. This is Song for Strayhorn.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reconsiders the recordings Fats Waller made toward the end of his life, music that's often been overlooked and has just been reissued. Poet Li Yongli's father was once Mao's private physician. He was later a political prisoner in Indochina. After his miraculous escape, the family fled from country to country under assumed names. Li Yongli talks with us about his alienation from his own family past. And TV critic David Bianculli looks at three Christmas specials that avoid sentimentality. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. A suspected pipe bomb sent in the mail to the Court of Appeals building in Atlanta has been dismantled by a bomb squad. Investigators will now try to see if it is linked to Saturday's bombing death of an Alabama member of the same court. Ed Hula reports.
The package containing the suspected bomb was found in the mailroom of the Court of Appeals building in downtown Atlanta. After evacuating the building and surrounding streets, the Atlanta Police Bomb Squad moved in to take the package away.
Looks like it could be a pretty good device. Person obviously knew what they were doing.
That's Captain Julian Spence of the Atlanta Bomb Squad. His officers this afternoon disarmed rather than detonate the device to compare it with evidence gathered from Saturday's bomb that killed U.S. Court of Appeals Judge Robert Vance in Birmingham. Atlanta FBI Special Agent in Charge Bill Henshaw declined to link the two events other than that they both concerned the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals and packages sent through the mail. For National Public Radio, this is Ed Hula in Atlanta.
A Savannah, Georgia attorney is reported in critical condition after what police say was a separate explosion at his office. Reporter Jim Carswell of television station WTOC in Savannah has more.
An explosion went off in Robbie Robinson's law office in Midtown Savannah. He apparently was sitting at his desk in his office when the bomb went off. The bomb apparently was either on his desk or very near it. The force of the explosion apparently blew off both of his arms as well as caused some massive chest injuries. He's been taken to a local trauma center where he's in critical condition right now. The alcohol, tobacco, and firearms folks have been called in to investigate to try and determine just exactly what kind of an explosion it was.
Reporter Jim Carswell in Savannah. In Washington, the White House said today that National Security Advisor Brent Scowcroft made a secret trip to China in July. NPR's Phyllis Crockett reports.
1 month after hundreds died in a bloody crackdown by the Chinese government as they demonstrated for democracy, National Security Advisor Scowcroft made the covert trip to China. A White House statement released today said Scowcroft undertook the mission to China for President Bush, quoting now, to personally underscore the United States' shock and concern about the violence in Tiananmen Square, unquote. The president has come under intense criticism from Democrats in Congress, and no Republicans have come to his defense for sending Scowcroft and State Department official Lawrence Eagleburger on a trip to China earlier this month. That trip was announced at 2 a.m. on a weekend morning after they had already landed in China. I'm Phyllis Crockett at the White House.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials closed down 42 points to close at 2,697.53. On Vima, some 184 million shares. Trading was active. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. In the 1930s and 40s, singer and pianist Thomas Fats Waller was one of the most popular American entertainers. He made about 500 recordings and wrote more than 300 songs, including standards like Ain't Misbehavin' and Honeysuckle Rose. Fats Waller died of pneumonia in 1943 at the age of 39. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead has a review of a new collection of Waller's music from the 40s, considered by many to be his least productive period. But Kevin says Waller could be great in spite of the obstacles placed in his way.
Fats Waller was too good for his own good. He could sing any song set in front of him, so his producers would assign him the most idiotic material they could find.
My, my, dig that pan. Say, boy, for the cat's information, I'll try to describe your face. In fact, I'll take the stand and try to review your case. Of course, I know, on the other hand, no one for miles around can equal your pan, no sir.
Pan, pan,
looks like a dishpan.
Pan, pan,
must be a moose pan.
Pan, pan,
boy, you got some pan, some pan.
Fats Waller is often portrayed as a serious artist trapped behind the mask of an entertainer. A man forced to play the clown by crass producers and a shallow public. But to see Waller as laughing on the outside and crying on the inside does him a disservice. His comedy was too lively for someone just going through the motions. He also enjoyed subverting weak material. On the immortal Eep, Ipe, Want a Piece of Pie, he garbles the lyrics so badly you'd think he'd been coached by Mel Blanc.
If I've coppers on the walk, if I've sounds like double talk, if I've if way, if pop, 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 you do it all day. If the choir on the Copenhagen is worthwhile, then the if you have set the style, if you put a racket sack in your hole real tight, and if pop, 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 I guess you do all right. When you pocket up your lips and then you hold real tight, let it go, it's bound to do all right. Come on, children. One, two, three. Together. Come on, follow me. If I want a sweet pie.
It's true that Waller's reputation as a singer, comedian, and songwriter has overshadowed his genius as a stride pianist. Stride piano was a streamlined descendant of ragtime. It was developed in Harlem in the teens and 20s by players like Waller's mentor, James P. Johnson. But Johnson's student was the most modern and graceful of the lot.
Going.
Waller's virtuosity as a piano player was rarely separated from his sense of humor. Music doesn't communicate ideas very well. I'm talking about music, not lyrics. But it's hard to miss the wit in Waller's bright sound, bouncing rhythm, and rolling triplets. Recordings are from a 3-CD Waller box set from RCA called The Last Years, 1940 to 1943. It includes some alternate takes never released before. In his final years, Waller recorded maudlin pop tunes, juvenile nonsense, and a few numbers that played on his prodigious appetite for food and drink.
Who's the one that I adore, though he beats me to the floor? Old granddad, my old granddad. He's my pappy's pappy. Who's the one that knows the tricks? When I'm wrong, he gives me kicks. Old granddad, my old granddad. He's my uncle's father. All my cousins, nieces, nephews, no old grand's command. You must act right. You must live right if you want to meet him in promised land.
Look, like some other silly songs that Fats sang, he wrote that one, which is another sign he wasn't a totally unwilling comic. Waller was also the first and greatest jazz organ player. His late 1920s pipe organ sides are astonishing. You may remember them from the movie Eraserhead. The electric organ tunes here, though, are far below his best. They're music for skating. In the months following Pearl Harbor, Waller recorded a couple of tunes for the war effort, including one number that's ripe for recycling by environmentalists.
Save up all your pots and pans. Save up every little thing you can. Don't give it away. Get some cash for your trash, yeah. Save up all that old newspaper. Save and pile it like a high skyscraper. Don't give it away. Get some cash for your trash.
The slogan, cash for your trash, could be a metaphor for Fats Waller's commercial success. But he always found something of artistic value in the rubbish. Even the dumbest tunes have splendid piano work. Fats Waller wasn't just a great musician. He was an existential hero. The way he confronted the pressures of 20th century life, the way he laughed in the face of mediocrity and wartime hardships, the way he used humor not just as a vehicle for laughter, but as a means of addressing the very...
You run your mouth, I'll run my business, brother. You run your mouth, and I'll run my business, brother.
Writer and critic Kevin Whitehead runs his mouth and minds his business in New York City. He reviewed Fats Waller and his rhythm, The Last Years, on the RCA Bluebird label. This is Fresh Air. When poet Lee Young Lee was a child, he says he prayed to God, but as he grew older, he discovered he'd been praying to his father. This powerful and almost mythic figure of his father runs throughout Lee Young Lee's first book of poems. Lee's great-grandfather was the first president of the People's Republic of China. Lee's father was personal physician to Mao Zedong and later a philosopher in Indonesia. During the rise of President Sukarno, the political climate grew hostile toward the Chinese and Western philosophy. Lee's father was imprisoned as a subversive. He escaped in 1961. Li Yongli's family wandered throughout Southeast Asia under assumed names before settling in Hong Kong. There they went from poverty to fabulous wealth as the father built an evangelical ministry that elevated him to celebrity status. Li Yongli was six when his family moved to a small mining town in western Pennsylvania, where his father became a Presbyterian minister. Li Yongli's poetry reflects a struggle with an imposing family heritage that often seemed remote and unreal. I asked him to read a passage from his poem, Furious Versions, about his father's capture in Indonesia.
Soldiers sweep the streets for my father. My mother hides him, haggard, in the closet. The booted ones herd us to the sea. Waves furl boats lovingly and bodies going out, farther out. Now my father holds my hand. He says, don't forget any of this. A short, bony-faced corporal asks politely, deferring to class, what color suit, professor, would you like to be buried in, brown or blue? A pistol butt turns my father's spit to blood.
How old were you when the memory that the poem describes happened, when that incident happened?
I must have been about 3 years old. I should probably say to her, a lot of my memories are unclear to me. And the memory I had in mind was actually, it turned out, was a story that my father told me when I was very young. And he told me the story over and over again. Each night he would wake up with these nightmares, and he would tell me about a story of lying there and a soldier asking him, what color suit would you like to be buried in? And somehow that story lodged in my brain as a memory. But in fact, it was a story that he told me. But then I do remember, there are other incidences in the poem Furious Versions that I actually remember having witnessed.
But that's the thing about memory. You sometimes don't know whether you've made it up, whether it's something somebody's told you, or whether you actually lived it.
Yeah, it's so difficult, especially when your survival depends on what you remember. I think that while we were wandering around in Southeast Asia, a lot of our survival depended on what we could commit to memory. And yet the doom in that, of course, is that your memory isn't reliable. You revise things in your memory. And as a result, if you are what you remember and your memory keeps revising things, then you keep getting revised. There are stories, for instance, that I recall, and my father is a character in them. And yet when I remember asking him about them, and he would say, no, that wasn't us. That was another family that we got separated from, and this and that. So I feel as if I'm walking around with not only my own luggage, but other people's luggage. And,
yeah, right.
You know, it's kind of strange.
Uh-huh. Well, you've written that when you were living in Hong Kong, where your father was an evangelical preacher, that you all lived in a penthouse, but you were not really allowed outside of the penthouse.
Yeah, that was... I don't know whether that's... simply peculiar to my father or all Chinese families are like that, but he was extremely domineering and tyrannical, and he had a real fear, I think, of the outside world, and I think I read that fear, and early on I began to sense that the world was a fearful place to live in. You know, maybe that finally is what's more interesting to me is not my background so much, all the illustrious things about my family, so much as how little those things had to do with me,
mm-hmm.
Living here in America. So it's that sense of dislocation that really interests me right now in my own writing.
Now, you've written that because you traveled around so much and kind of changed identities in a way so much when you were young that you became convinced that life was a series of disconnected episodes that did not cohere.
Right.
And I was wondering if there's anything you could do to give a coherence, and if reading helped to give a coherence.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, watching my father, all that time while we were traveling around, my father would be translating from the Old Testament, and he did it doggedly, and he was persistent about it, and he was absolutely sure that that was one way to stay sane while the background was changing and the country was changing and the language and the food and the music was changing. He was doing this one activity, translating the Old Testament. And I saw then that literature for him was like bread, like blood, water, you know. It wasn't a parlor game. And I began to have a real deep love, not only for the Old Testament, but for what poetry and literature could mean.
Was there a point in your life when you started to see family stories as a form of literature?
I have a fear of that, actually. I feel as if, you know, my friends who are novelists and prose writers tell me, geez, you know, you're so lucky. I would kill to have your life. And I think it's kind of, it is a blessing, but it's also a doom, a curse, because I end up trying to work harder at making art. I mean, I could tell stories, and they're exotic, and they're interesting, and they even have human import. But somehow, as an artist, you have to do something with it. It has to be transformed, you know. Emerson, I think it was, talks about man being an alembic through which nature is passed, you know. And it has to pass through me to become art. It'd be too easy simply to tell the stories, you know, to assume their importance.
You've said that when that there was a period when the stories that were in your family you kind of rejected because it didn't seem to be about you. You didn't identify with that part of your family's past, but that changed for you later on. And I was wondering what changed that.
Yeah, you know, the change was quite recent, about a year and a half ago. I really did have the sense that those stories had nothing to do with me. I would hear wonderful stories about wealth and opulence and eccentricities of my ancestors, and they had nothing to do with me growing up in western Pennsylvania in a mill town. You know, I would walk to school and the steel mills would be there belching smoke, and it had nothing to do with me, I would feel. But lately, I feel differently. Something happened. About a year and a half ago, I got this letter from a wonderful man. It's from Houston, Texas. He said he saw my name somewhere. I think it was in the New York Times about some award or something. And he noticed that I was born in Indonesia. And he said he was an Indonesian. And as a fellow Indonesian, he wanted to congratulate me and say hello and so on. And he signed his name in English and in Chinese. So I sat down to return the letter. And my sister saw the letter and said, well, I know this man. And I laughed it off, thinking she was given to enthusiasms, and she insisted she was right, and she showed it to my mother. And my mother began to weep openly. And she said, this man was your father's cellmate.
Oh.
In Indonesia. So immediately I wrote back to him, and I told him who I was. And we've been in touch ever since. And I plan to meet him at some point. And he's been able to already tell me a few things about my father that I could have guessed, but I didn't really know. You know, he said, for instance, my father was a very serious, brooding young man while he was in prison. And that was important to me, to know that about him. And now I'm beginning to feel, you see, that this connection. And I really do feel I'm going to piece everything back together now. And I'm going to find out exactly what I am and what I am not.
You've done so much reading. Are there any characters in fiction that you find yourself really identifying with, who helped you figure out something of who you were?
Yeah, absolutely. All the characters of the Old Testament. I love the Old Testament. You know, and there's my father again. He taught me to love the Old Testament, and I do love it. All those stories of those people who had to change their names. You know, I was just reading the book of Daniel, reading about how Daniel and his three friends had to change their names when Nebuchadnezzar came into power, and they had to observe the rites, the religious rites of this other culture, and they refused to do that, you know. Just stories like that. I love those stories, stories about how people survive in the face of annihilation and persecution. How they survive while wandering in the wilderness. I love those stories, you know, stories of courage and power.
I'd like to close with a poem. You have a book of your poems called Rose, and there's a poem in it called Rain Diary that I'd mm-hmm. like you to read a passage from.
Okay. By now, my father's hair has grown past his shoulders. What name would he answer to, this father of sleepless nights and stories of camps where his spit turned to blood? Father of the thousand-mile sadness, the rocking ship, and the melancholy of trains. Father of fatigue and the bitter bowl, whom I asked once, where are we going? My question could have been, in what country will your pillow finally come to rest and the rain call you home? His answer would have been the same, my father of this America and a divided tongue. As a boy, I lay quietly beside while he napped. I was practicing to lie down by his grave. father beneath the grass, collecting the myriad waves of rain in buckets and cans the way we did in Pittsburgh in 1964. I remember his poverty, winters, and the trials by rain. I remember holes in the ceiling, his face leaning into his own hands. I remember my father of rain.
Lee Young Lee, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Lee Young Lee's first book of poems, Rose, is published by BOA Editions. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered and check in with Robert Siegel. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry. We have reports today of a repression of demonstrations in Romania, where Nicolae Ceausescu rules the very iron fist. No signs so far there of the kinds of political reforms we've seen elsewhere in the Soviet bloc, but now the opposition seems to be mounting, and there are reports of deaths as police have put down those demonstrations. Also, Andrei Sakharov's funeral in Moscow, and a report about Washington, D.C.'s infant mortality rate. It turns out that the nation's capital has the worst infant mortality rate of any city in the country.
Thanks, Robert. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. This week, A Very Brady Christmas is being shown again on TV. Last year, when the special premiered, it drew the second highest ratings for the year, right behind the Karen Carpenter story. TV critic David Bianculli says, bah humbug to all those Christmas repeats.
It's bad enough that all the old Christmas specials are repeated on TV each year. Most people have VCRs now, and it's tough to get worked up about the 22nd showing of A Charlie Brown Christmas if you taped it 5 years ago. Besides, of all those old Christmas shows and specials, only about 6 of them are any good. But what's worse is that the networks keep making new ones, and not just specials, but special episodes of weekly series. Mr. Belvedere, Amen, and the famous Teddy Z did Christmas episodes last week, and A Different World, Tour of Duty, and even L.A. Law are doing them this week. Now, I'm as much into the holiday spirit as the next guy, especially if the next guy is Ebenezer Scrooge, but enough is enough. There are so many Christmas specials now that TV starts showing them before Thanksgiving just to cram them all in. And they're going to keep making them as long as people keep watching them. But there's a trend this year that makes watching some of these new specials more fun than frightening. Fox and cable are sprinkling some of their holiday specials with healthy doses of irreverence, probably because their writers are as tired of the traditional specials as I am. Take the animated special starring The Simpsons, which premiered Sunday and is being repeated this Saturday. In it, parents Marge and Homer watch as their son Bart takes part in the school Christmas pageant, singing an impromptu solo. This past Sunday, on another Fox show, Married with Children, Peg tried to surprise her husband Al by coming to bed wearing a sexy red negligee and a giant green bow.
Come unwrap your Christmas present.
Where is it?
It's me, you Phoebe.
Oh, Peg, how do you expect me to get excited when you just rewrapped the same old junk I didn't play with you before?
That show evolved into a takeoff on It's a Wonderful Life, but with a deliciously wicked twist. In this version, the guardian angel who shows Al what life would be like without him is played by Sam Kinison. And in every respect, Al's family is better off without him. Here's the very start of Al's angelic tour.
Peg, it's me and my angel.
She doesn't know you're there, buddy. Just like when you're having sex.
Another Christmas show with a twist premieres on Christmas Eve, when Arts and Entertainment presents Blackadder's Christmas Carol. It's the same old story, except told in reverse. In this version, Blackadder starts out as the nicest man in London, but after being shown visions of how his nasty ancestors profited from their greed and evil, he becomes so mean-spirited that he's rude to Christmas carolers. In this particular case, though, they deserve it.
Commence of the season, sir. We have come to sing merrily and to make you a gift of a small pudding. 3, 4, God bless Mr. B at Christmas time and baby Jesus too. If we were little pigs, we'd sing piggy, wiggy, 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 boo. Piggy, wiggy, 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 boo. Oh, piggy, wiggy, wiggy, woo. Piggy, wiggy, woo. Oh, piggy, wiggy, 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 woo.
Utter crap.
These kinds of shows make holiday TV more bearable. And remember, there are less than 7 viewing days left until Christmas.
David Bianculli is television critic for the New York Post. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Joyce Lieberman, Ron Barron, Richard Parker, and Thad Kirk. Chris Burgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
He's kind and generous to the sick. He'd never spread a nasty rumor. He never gets on people's wick. And doesn't laugh at toilet humor.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by this and other NPR member stations. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
In 1970, Dennis Hayes organized Earth Day to call attention to the threatened environment. On the next Fresh Air, Hayes lets us in on the plans for Earth Day 1990. Also, Charles Grodin tells some funny stories from his acting career. At least the stories are funny in retrospect. I'm Terry Gross, and I hope you'll join me for the next Fresh Air.